Good evening, and thank you all for coming, of course, and thanks for the exaggerations. I gave Rebecca a few topics for my talks, and it seems that most of the people, most of the organizers of the events, two weeks long events of a speaking tour, like this topic of the dilemmas of a journalist, with some variations. And now, right now, I feel that my main dilemma is how not to repeat myself, because today I already had two talks. And last night, the first one. So this is the dilemma, how not to repeat myself, and at the same time, how still to say the things that that should be said and that are important to be said. And actually, this indeed fits into my story of my life as a journalist, because writing about, you wrote Palestine, means to write about things that repeat themselves, while journalism or media in general prefers something which is new, right? So people, the readers and the editors get, so what's new about it? So as a journalist who covers Palestine, and I'll get to it soon, in a moment, I want and I need to report about what's happening. And what's happening is daily military raids into Palestinian houses and villages, and daily harassment of Palestinian farmers and shepherds, either by settlers or the Israeli military. Daily decrees that, or weekly decrees that confiscate land from Palestinians. Daily demolition of Palestinian homes, or weekly demolition of Palestinian homes, or even mobile toilets, or even confiscation of water tanks. This is a routine. And there is nothing that media or press or journalism hates more than routine. But what can I do if this is the reality? I call it sometimes the routine of catastrophes, which is also an oxymoron, because a catastrophe should be something, you know, not repetitive. It's something that happens once or twice, but it doesn't happen on a regular basis. But when you actually cover Palestinian life under Israeli domination, and this is a more accurate term than just Palestine, then you cover a chain or you cover Israeli performance of violent acts, which can be either military, physical, violence of nature, but mostly they are bureaucratic violence, something that we don't call violence, but it is. Because when you have a decree to confiscate somebody's land or to deny somebody a permit to go and see a sick mother or a sick father in Gaza Strip, or when you deny somebody the right to go and study in the West Bank, and this person studies in Jerusalem, lives in the Gaza Strip, this is violence, because you interfere with your military might. You interfere in somebody's normal life. So this routine of catastrophes to describe this routine of catastrophes is part of my job. And I came to realize, you know, giving talks from quite often taught me that sometimes maybe I have to summarize, where especially in this era of tweets and so I know that every Palestinian that I meet and that I know went through one sort of catastrophe in his life or her life because of Israel, because of my state. And I also know that it's very likely that this person and family will encounter another personal catastrophe, also again because of Israel, be it killing, be it death of a beloved person, imprisonment, injury, loss of work, loss of, again, land, loss of opportunities, something that changes life tremendously. And I do wonder, you know, when I live among, I mean, I live in Ramallah and I live among these people, and I'm always wondering how they can really bear it, how they can stand it. I think that this is one of the questions that underlies my much of my writing. Now, the temptation to write the routine, to describe the routine, and to describe in details cases, case by case, because I'm a journalist, I'm not a theoretician. I want to show the people and what they are going through. What I risk here is that the readers will take it as isolated cases, because you read cases, and I cannot write about every case. So they read about cases, and if I'm lucky and they forgot that I wrote about 500 such cases in the last 30 years, they will probably say, oh, but this is isolated, this is not so terrible. Taking the land from someone is not so terrible as, you look at Syria, they kill so many there. Or stopping somebody at a checkpoint, we too are waiting in our traffic jam for 3 hours or 2 hours, etc. Why do they complain? It's not so difficult. Red tape, you have red tape in Israel. You wait for a permit 2 weeks until your mother died and you couldn't go to the funeral. Yes, but red tape you also have in Israel. This can be the reaction. Or in general, yes, it's terrible, but it's isolated. It's just cases. Then how do I show that these cases have to be joined together and they should give a picture or the image of what is really going on, of a structure? Because there is a structure behind it. There is a structure behind the killings, as isolated as they are in the West Bank, and this is my article that I was published today, and there is a structure behind the so-called isolated confiscation of land. And the structure, there is a structure and there is a plan and there is a meaning. It is not haphazard. It did not happen. The fact that today, 25 or 26 years after the Oslo negotiations started, it's not an accident, bad luck, that we have not reached peace, or that Gaza is completely cut off, or that the West Bank is actually a cluster of isolated, disconnected enclaves in which Palestinians live, and that they are surrounded by Israeli-dominated territory or in the West Bank. All these things are not by chance. And I find it tragic. I find it infuriating. I find it sad for me as an Israeli Jew to say that Israel did plan. Israel did have a master plan. When it started the negotiations, and it wanted to foil the two-state solution. This kind of settlement, of arrangement, I started to hate the word solution, but some kind of settlement that Palestinians were ready for. It was very bitter for them. It was very, it is a very hard a compromise for them to accept a state in 23% of historical Palestine. They still feel attached and belonging to the entire country. They can relate to the original villages of their families till today. But at a certain moment, at the beginning of the 90s, they believed that Israel was ready to renounce its colonialistic characteristic. And by colonialistic or settler colonialistic characteristics, I mean this project of taking land from in a certain place, which is not yours, settling there people who come from the outside at the expense of the indigenous people, and then exclude these indigenous people from the political structure that is being created, the body politic that is being created. And this is unfortunately the process that brought Israel into being, but it is not the only one. It is not the only one because there was another component here or another historical context. We have to remember that until Nazism rose to power and until anti-Semitism became became genocidal, only a minority of the Jews in the world chose Zionism as a solution to anti-Semitism, to persecution, to economical poverty. Most of them had many other options. They felt okay in the diaspora. They opted for the diaspora. And they probably had sentiments, especially those who still retained a connection with their religious tradition. They had sentiment to this Holy Land, but it was not going to be a practical connection. They emigrated as those some of you might, I mean, many of you, I guess, can relate to it personally. They emigrated from Eastern Europe and from Central Europe when still America accepted Jews. And they emigrated to other places. They chose assimilation. Others joined socialist and communist movements, believing that these movements will change the world, so then anti-Semitism will disappear. So I think you know all those options that were. But the thing is that the diaspora showed that it didn't want the Jews. And you know about the change of the law, immigration law in the States in 1924, and similar ones in England, and the Conference of Evian, which did not, where no state was able to accept Jewish refugees in the 30s who fled Nazi Germany. So we cannot, here is where we cannot relate to Israel just as a product of colonialism or of settler colonialism, of European state of mind that anybody who is not white is actually redundant or doesn't count. Many of the Jews who arrived to Palestine, Israel in the 30s and the 40s and really made the number of Jews there tripled and doubled and tripled it, were refugees themselves. We cannot disconnect it. And that is also why in the era of decolonization, the war of, as we call it in Israel, the independence, was seen by the Jews inside the country as a war for life, as their war for existence. Yes, they did not see the Palestinians who lived there. And it was, you know, three years after the end of the Second World War, which had 12 million refugees. And, some more, 300,000, 700,000 refugees. What is it in a world full of refugees? So the plight of Jews does not annul the plight of the Palestinians, and vice versa. Only with the only difference that it's not the Palestinians who are responsible for our plight. You would expect that Israeli Jews would have been attentive to the plight of Palestinians. And in a way, I think that the negation, the denial in Israel for many years, the denial of the Nakba, of the existence of Palestinians, in a way it shows that people were aware of it. The official denial shows that you know that somebody suffered tremendously and was wronged tremendously because of our success in changing the course for the Jewish people. So back to 93. I cannot say that the Palestinians, when they accepted the partition and the idea of a Palestinian state in 67 borders, that they accept this kind of abbreviated historiography that I proposed now of the state of Israel. But they accepted Israel as a fact. They accepted the Israeli society. And it's not by accident that the people who drove to this acceptance of the two-state solution were the Palestinians from the inside, who were 10, 12, 13 years old in 67. And the war let them see the Israeli society and realize it is not an artificial society. They were, until the war, all those people who did not know Israel, all those Palestinian refugees, and some, I think, that supporters on the left in Europe, even in the 50s and 60s, used to relate to Israel as an artificial society. And something, and this is something that I heard, you know, a rotten, you know, something that will wither away or fall down like a rotten apple. And once the borders, these borders of 48 were open for them, and they could see, no, that there is an Israeli society. And it's there to remain. And there are even likable things about the Israeli society. It's very funny that quite a few people of those, the new leaders of the Oslo times, were in the past prisoners. Because in a strange way, there were Palestinian prisoners came to know Israeli society also through prisons. They met guards and they even met, you know, criminals. So they met normal people, ordinary people, and they befriended. And I have many such stories, you know, of people, especially in Gaza, that I met and had made friends in prison, and made them realize that, no, that there must be, one cannot think about eternal or long struggle, armed struggle for liberation, and expect this to happen, to succeed, because it will be wrong, it will be bad for both sides, and especially for the Palestinian side. So these kind of people pushed for a compromise or a solution. And there is nothing final in history. There is no final solution in history. So once you have a two-state solution, a two-state reality, where security is not anymore a problem, where you can exchange when you have normal trade relations, and you visit each other, and you have diplomatic relations. So things can move forward and change, but this is on the condition that you don't have one group which is superior to another. When you agree that the basis is equality, and the basis is that there are no privileges here to one group over the other. The relationship is not based on military might. As an expression of this would have been the full withdrawal from the 67 occupied territory. That was more or less the understanding of a big segment of Israeli society, that settlements and peace are irreconcilable. Yeah, or something. Yes. And that settlements should be evacuated in order for a Palestinian state to be created. There was an understanding, of course, among all the Palestinians. And also, according to UN resolutions, we can say that the international community understood that this should be the right course. This was the basis. This is how people saw the Oslo Accords. Personally, I was very suspicious. By then, I lived in Gaza, and I also read, and with friends who are more legalistically inclined than me, we read carefully the Oslo Accords. And what was strange, what was standing out, is that, you know, they talked about gradual way to reach peace. But there was nowhere in the Oslo Accords where the goal was stated. How can you, to what? Okay, we can accept the graduality, the need of gradual redeployment of Israeli troops from the West Bank. But what is the goal? And the goal was not stated. And Palestinians in a very, I think that one of their big, one of the things that we have to blame them for is their naivete, bordering its stupidity, especially later when Israel showed that it has no intention to stop the settlement project and the settlement activity. Now people say both sides are responsible like this and that, but there is no way that you can convince me that bringing more Israelis to settle in a place, in an area that should be a Palestinian state, shows any goodwill on the part of Israel. And this is what happened from day one. It happened in an incremental way. You know, step by step, without rush, without big declarations, so that people don't notice. The big declarations were about peace. Shimon Peres was the master of such declarations, so much that the world loved him. But he was against the Palestinian state. It was very clear he was, and he said it very openly, he was against Palestinian sovereignty or Palestinian Masir Takrir. Self-determination, yes. He was against it. He started talking about two states only in the 2000s and so. In 95, he still offered Arafat to declare a state in Gaza. Gaza only. Arafat rejected this. The process that I can, you know, show, I can say that I see it from my window almost, or from the roads that I drive in the West Bank going back home from Jerusalem to El Bire, where I live in the West Bank. While in 91, on the eve of the Madrid conference, and then 93, even Oslo, the idea was, and I repeat myself again, that the state will be in the 67 occupied territory with East Jerusalem as capital for the Palestinian state and West Jerusalem capital of Israel. And there was this expanse or space, Palestinian space. Okay, yes, which is where there are some Israeli Jewish enclaves of settlements. And the solution and the way to reach a state is to remove the settlements. There were some tens of thousands of settlers in the West Bank without Jerusalem. There were a bit more in Jerusalem. But the concept should have been clear, that settlers have to be removed. And now slowly, slowly, within those, during these 25 years, we see the inverse, that the Palestinian expanse became an Israeli expanse with Palestinian enclaves inside. So you have Gaza as the main enclave, and then you have a duplication of those enclaves in the West Bank, separated areas congested with population, engulfed by Israeli-controlled area. And when I say Israeli-controlled, is where Israel have the full authority, not only military authority, which it has all over, and all over the West Bank, but an administrative and civilian authority to issue permits for construction, for building, for drilling of water, for electricity, economical expansion, whatever. And surprise, surprise, these permits are given to Israeli settlers, but is not given to Palestinians, the indigenous population of the West Bank. This is not by accident. This is not a mistake. This is planned. And as a journalist, I have followed this consistency of Israeli planning and Israeli measures from the mid-90s. I moved to Ramallah in 97. I moved to the West Bank from Gaza in 97. And at first I was, a fresh woman there. It was all new to me. I knew Gaza. My accent was Gazan. People asked me if I was from Gaza or laughed at me because Ramallah people are a bit haughty, snobbish. So my accent was very heavy Gazan. But I started going around. Went, for example, to one of the first places where I went to was the Northern Jordan Valley. And people told me they are demolishing Palestinian houses. It's not really houses, it's shacks, it's tents. It's because an area where Israel does not give a permit to build. The land is privately owned by Palestinians. They cultivated the land since they can remember their grandparents. But they are not allowed to stay there. They are allowed to cultivate the land. Israel cannot say it's not their land, but they are not allowed to build there. So they build because they have to have a roof above their heads, and the Israelis come and demolish it. And one person told me, they came with the civil administration, it's one of those organs, hybrid organs that are half civilian, half military. I asked them, he told me, where shall I go now that you demolish my home? And they told him, go to Area A, to Arafat. Area A is it's really boring to explain, to tell. But Area A is, according to the Oslo negotiations, was the first area where the Israeli army should redeploy. So the Area A is the Palestinian cities, towns. Then the Area B is the second stage from which the Israelis should redeploy, but where Palestinians would have civilian authorities and administrative authorities, so they can build and build the grids or repair the grids or whatever, but do not have policing authorities. In Area A, they do have. Their police can go around with arms, but not in Area B. And Area C is the villages, and the Area C are the mostly land reservoir of the Palestinian people. And this Area C is, in until today, Israeli full control. So the Israeli soldier told this Palestinian from Frush Bedajan, the name of the place, you go to A, you go to Arafat. And I heard this, as I said, this at noon. You know, from soldiers, you hear the truth much more than you hear from officials, higher officials, because they don't have this diplomatic filtering. So you learn a lot from such remarks. There is a diplomat, international diplomat, that told me the following story, that the Israelis, they meet with the Israelis, and one of the Israelis said, also very openly, ha ha ha, you know what ABC is? A is Arafat, B is Balagan. Balagan in Hebrew is mess, and or you can say in French bordel, but the meaning in Balagan, and C is Shelanu, ours in Hebrew. And this was very early on, sometime in the 90s. It shows, it doesn't even show the subconscious. It shows the hidden transcripts of the reality that were not told in open press conferences and in interviews, festive interviews of Shimon Peres, etc. So how are you here talking about dilemma? How do you describe this process? I mean, this process also when I don't have the smoking gun. I don't have the documents, because the documents, I'm not the type of journalist that a prime minister calls in the morning and said, wow, I have a great scoop for you. But you see the reality. And I've learned through my work as a journalist, I've learned to be quite intolerant with words and promises and declarations. And you see things under your eyes. Also, one of the early experiences that I had as a journalist in the West Bank was I was called to a Palestinian village northeast of Ramallah, Jalut, that has one farmer who had about 100 or so olive trees cut by anonymous people. I remember it as if I were there yesterday. I mean, the sight of butchered trees, really, because you can see the care in which he cultivated his land. You could see that the trees were really old. He said that he helped planting them, or now I don't remember. He helped planting his father, but this looked like quite old trees. And he was a known farmer who really cared for his land. I think he must have had at least 5 or 6 attacks, direct attacks at his fields and land and trees over 10 years or 15 years. And with the years I would go in each such attack, or almost each such attack, I would visit him, and he would always look older in 10 years. Because he also had legal fights with the settlers. Of course, we know it's settlers who did it. Because it's an area that now Israelis know it as Emek Shiloh. It is an area with five or six very, very fertile villages with very fertile land. And it started with one settlement or two. These two settlements bred 5 or 6 or 7, I don't know, outposts, some of the most violent outposts in the West Bank. And especially it started before the Second Intifada, but especially with the beginning of the Second Intifada, they would terrorize the farmers who went to their fields. It was Second Intifada, so the Israeli army rushed in, not to interfere, but to prohibit the Palestinians from reaching their land. So slowly, slowly, for about 8 years, the Palestinians could not reach their land, and surprise, surprise, the land became beautiful orchards and beautiful vineyards of Israeli settlers. So around 9,000 dunams, also of pasture, are completely cut off now from the Palestinians. They have to prove that they are the owners of the land. And sometimes, you know, if the land belongs to the village and it's not written as private property of a person, who says it's not the village's land? This process that happened in Emek Shiloh was similar to what was happening all over the West Bank. So again, congesting or creating this expanse of Israeli cultivated lands and congesting the Palestinians into their Bantustans or reservations. I see, and I will end here and we can start with the questions. I see this phenomenon, this reality of Bantustans or reservations or enclaves, that at any moment two soldiers can cut off from each other. Because when you drive in the West Bank, you will notice that along the roads there are iron gates. Iron gates that can be closed and shut the exit, or already do, the exit of villages to main roads, and exits that connect one area to another. At any moment, these enclaves can be really disconnected from each other, like Gaza is disconnected from the rest. It is not the doing of the settlers, because if Israel wanted to stop the violence of settlers, it would have done so easily. They get the license to be to attract attention by their pirate violence, while the state doing much more in confiscating land in its official violence. I see those reservations, or what I call the seven-state solution, not the two-state solution, but the seven-state solution, as the Israeli true compromise, internal compromise, between the wish to see Palestinians disappear and the geopolitical understanding that this is impossible, that we cannot dispose of the Palestinians like we did in 1948. Already in 67 there were attempts to expel Palestinians again. They succeeded in the Jordan Valley, but much less so in the West Bank and in Gaza. It's not possible now. So the solution, we congest them and we just ignore them. They have their self-rule. Let them, excuse me for the language, rot in their problems, and let the world pay for example, for the loss, economical loss, that Israeli restrictions cause. Because when I'm talking about the 61% that Israel controlled in the West Bank, or about disconnecting Gaza from the West Bank, or about not allowing Gaza to export, to produce and export, we are, of course, talking about these personal catastrophes of millions of people, but we also talk about shattered economy, an economy that is being completely paralyzed. You don't need to be an economist to understand how harmful it is. For example, when I drive from my place, instead of driving 15 kilometers to Jerusalem, I have to do a detour of 23 kilometers. Now, okay, I can bear it, I can afford it. But think about the whole economy, that this is the rule, that instead of for a truck that brings goods from one place to another, instead for this company to pay for equivalent for five kilometers, they do of 12 kilometers or 13, because so many villagers are disconnected from each other. So this is the Israeli compromise. The Bantustans are the real Israeli compromise, and the differences in Israeli political figures or parties is not about the concept of the Bantustans or the enclaves, but about the number and the size of those reservations. If, let's say, Labor would say, okay, four enclaves, Gaza and three others in the West Bank, Likud will say seven or eight or something. But now actually the tendency is to continue the fragmentation of the West Bank. I once wrote an article with the title The Seven State Solution, and I thought that I was very original. And then I discovered that there is a professor at Bar-Ilan University, Moti Kedar, who advocates what he says the solution of the Emirates. He says that the Palestinians should have those regions that more or less correspond to the Bantustans that I'm talking about. And in each one, there are the traditional families, the Hamulas, and they should rule each one separately. Yes. I really was offended, but that I'm not so. But this comes, and he's an Arabist. He's an expert, supposed to be an expert of Arabs, and that's what he advocates. Now, this milieu of right-wing, religious, messianic groups in Israel, which is becoming more and more influential in Israeli politics, and we saw it just recently when Netanyahu had to support the participation of a party that once was outlawed as a Kahanist party, Otzma Israel. So he pushed for them to be in the to run and to be accepted. And this is a party which advocates expulsion of Palestinians. But there are many other groups among this milieu of Israeli messianic religious right-wing circles that calls for expulsion. And again, things are, you know, there are hidden transcripts or hidden words, but you can sense it when somebody says, Palestinians should thank us that they are still here. You know, it's a favor. It's not their natural right. Or when you hear people saying, the real way to punish Palestinians who had were engaged in some military activity or whatever, or killed Israelis, it's not enough to demolish the home of the family. They rebuild it immediately. It's not enough to put them in prison for life. We should expel the whole family. We should expel more. Now Israel is not a society where you find people who stand up against attempts of mass expulsion of Palestinians. And when I say it, and now I promise again, really to finish, is not, I say it not because I want to prophesize. I want to alarm, I want to warn. I think it is preventable. Palestinians are not the same, like, they're not in the same stage as they were in 48. Even though many are opting for emigration because they cannot stand life, this kind of life of permanent uncertainty, and with very high rate of unemployment, especially for young people. So this is preventable, but for this we have to be aware that this possibility, that there is such a possibility and such a tendency among groups that are growing in number and in importance in the Israeli politics. Thank you.
Would you like to take for the questions? How long do you want to take?
Thank you. Could you please define a couple terms that you used? Enclave and reservation. Just talk about what you mean by those terms.
Okay, this is, we haven't mentioned Hamas at all. And the tragedy of Soda Street, it was going beautifully. We destroyed it. Why? Because they don't want peace. And why did the Palestinians destroy all the agricultural development in the north of...
Well, you're second generation Holocaust survivor. My question to you is, you show a remarkable sensitivity and passion towards justice. And I'm curious to know how your background as a second generation Holocaust survivor is informing that passion and that clarity.
Okay, thank you. I'm sorry about the two terms that you, and thank you for asking me to define it. Enclave or reservation, I say reservation because it is should be more familiar to you in America, is a designated territory that has different, a certain population that is different from others in the same region, different rules. It cannot expand, it cannot, practically speaking, cannot expand, cannot, it is in a very defined, it is a defined area, artificially defined area, in a total which makes it separate from other, without contiguity to other areas.
Seven?
No, I mean, there are, you know, it can be seven, it can be 15, it can be six. The process, we didn't manage to bring the map here, but the process, we can show you later the process is that, how can I, the map of the state is not, but look at Illinois and think about, take five cities or five big towns and just cut them off, all what's connecting between those towns, make it into a, let's say, Mexico. So Chicago will be United States, but everything around Chicago will be Mexico. So this is the enclave of Chicago. Now, I didn't speak about many things, I admit. Though I must say that somebody already in the morning asked me the same question about the, about not Hamas, but yeah, a little, in a way, like it looked like a bit the same, I don't know, source or saw the stream, not, it's new, is not, was not asked. Look, I can talk certainly 5 or 6 hours about Hamas, at least. For sure, it'll be very interesting. And it is interesting, but I don't want to pretend here that I'm an Israeli Jew, and I'm speaking to an audience or in a country that is the greatest ally of Israel and supports Israel in its policies. And I speak here to an audience, I don't know how many of you are Jews, but I assume that there are some, right? I met at least one this afternoon, yes. And you as Jews have, right, tomorrow you can emigrate to Israel. The second day that you emigrate, you will get benefits that no Palestinian can dream about. You can get to live wherever you want in the country. You can move and be my neighbor in Bet El settlement. But a Ramallah-born Palestinian who happened to be in 1967, not in Ramallah, but in United States, does not have the right to go back and live on his own land. And maybe his land was confiscated for the settlement of Bet El. But you, as American citizen, can also become a citizen of Israel and live on Palestinian land, stolen Palestinian land, in right now, and get work there. And a Palestinian who lives in the, who got married to a Palestinian who was born in the States, but Palestinian, and goes and marries a Palestinian in the West Bank, that is not allowed to work if he or she want to live in their own home with their family. One of Israeli regulations, because Israel also controls not only the water and the sea and the sky and the borders, but it also controls the registry of population. So this is the reason that I'm talking about Israel and not about Hamas. Hamas, yeah, I mean, we have, and also about Fatah, I didn't speak much. And I didn't speak about, you know, Palestinian art. I think it's beautiful. And I would have loved to speak about it. And no, it's not funny. It's really, I mean, I wish I had the time to follow all the cultural events that do happen in the enclaves. They do happen in those enclaves. There is poetry. I wish I my Arabic were better, so in order to understand the poetry that is written, etc. So there are many things that I didn't write about. Now, Hamas, yes, Hamas is one of the developments of political developments, unlike many people in Israel and who claim that Hamas is a creation of Israel, because Israel supported during the 70s and 80s when Israel wanted to weaken the PLO, it allowed the Islamic movement in Gaza and also in the West Bank to have activities that were forbidden from to PLO, and they had the possibility to have all sorts of associations and build the mosques and gather people and influence them. While they were arresting members of the PLO who convened, who had assemblies or met more than, I don't know, 10 people in a room. So there is a claim by some Palestinians and also by Israeli scholars, not only laymen, that Hamas is the creation of Israel. I do not agree. I think it is a genuine development of a Palestinian society, but I think that Hamas got stronger and stronger because the camp, the Palestinian camp, which advocated for this compromise of two states, failed because the two states, the state, the Palestinian state, was not created. I remember when I lived in Gaza, a leader of Hamas, back then they still gave me interviews, today they don't, but he told me, you'll see, our people is a simple people. They are being promised and they think that things will get better. You'll see, and we tell them, you'll see that the Israelis, I think he said the Jews, I'm not sure, do not respect their promises, do not fulfill their promises. There will not be a state, prisoners will not be released, state will not be returned, etc. And then they are found to be right. I think that they also offer Hamas as a religious party, they offer people a lot of emotional solace, emotional comfort or compensation. Because life is not money, it's emotional compensation. It's not about money. I sat with two women whose sons and husband were in prison for many years for resisting the occupation. And one of them said the sentence, oh, the Jews, I mean, they will be punished, or God will punish them in the afterlife. And I said, oh, it helps you to say that? And the woman said, yes, of course. So she already renounced a change in her in life on earth. So you really you want to believe that there is an afterlife. And as another sheikh, a Bedouin sheikh, from a village that is destined to be demolished the day after tomorrow, Khan al-Ahmar, he told me, I don't understand, you know, this life is short, is nothing. 60 years, what is 60 years? So we suffer 60 years. But then we live for eternity. And that's when God is punishing the people who wrong the others. I don't think that many people believe in it, but certainly it is easier to believe in it if you live, if all your life, all what you saw is Israeli soldiers aiming at you here and there, and Israeli soldiers entering your house, and your father being beaten in front of the children, and your mother cannot go to the field. I mean, you need some comfort from this permanent violent invasion to your life. You want me to talk about SodaStream? So, no? Okay. Yeah. SodaStream is one of the Israeli companies that were positioned in a settlement area, industrial area, near in the middle of, east of Jerusalem, near Maale Adumim settlement, and it was one of the campaigns against it as a cooperation with the occupation, and they had to move And they did have some tens of workers there. But you see, this is demagoguery. You know, I know that this the Israelis played a lot on this demagoguery. It's because Palestinians are not allowed to build their own industry. Let them build their own industry, so they will not have unemployed people. Let them develop. Let them connect areas. Let them bring goods from Jordan and not only from Israel. Israel forces them still to be connected to the Israeli market. So there are many answers that I could give to this soda stream, but it becomes too specific, and the dilemma of time forces me to go to the third question. How did my background as child of survivors influence me? I think what probably had more, or let me say, my parents, and now I will say probably a word that is forbidden in America, my parents were communists. And they were communists, and they did not intend to come to Palestine, Israel. They were not Zionists. My mother wanted to remain in Yugoslavia, my father in Romania. But so it happened, and this connects us to the beginning of my talk, and so it happened that when we returned home, Yugoslavia and Romania, from concentration camp and ghetto, they realized that they were not welcome, even though they were they saw themselves as an integral part of the society. They were not welcome, because anti-Semitism during the Nazi occupation even grew deeper roots because of the Nazi occupation. So they found themselves in Israel in 48, beginning of 49, and the first thing they did was to join the Communist Party in Israel. So for me, this combination of Holocaust survivors and communists was almost inseparable. I can say that there are three things that I don't remember when I first knew about them. And this is my name, communism, and Holocaust. So that was the life, you know, of a red-diapered baby, but also of... So what influenced me more? My parents, too. Their communism was strengthened by their experience under the Nazi regime. With some people, it was different. It might have been the opposite. But that was my parents' way. And together, of course, it influenced me. It influenced me that my mother told me, and I write it in the preface to my book on Gaza, and she wrote it in the diary here, that one of the things that she shared with me, and it got so deep into me that I think that sometimes I was there, that when they were taken by train, by the cargo train, from where she was in Montenegro, from Yugoslavia to Bergen-Belsen, their concentration camp, they went down after 9 days, or I don't know how many days, in a cargo car. And she remembers that she saw the German women looking at them. And I said in my diary, in my introduction, I said with this, they looked at them with this, I think I said, curious indifference, or something like this, or indifferent curiosity. And this is for me an image that shows, that exemplifies standing by, the bystander. And I lost it. As a child, I lost it because I connected it. So you can say it of course influenced me. But I think it's difficult to separate. Certainly, in that sense, the education of my parents is a proof now that I'm not a rebel, because I followed in the footsteps of my parents.
You mentioned the two-state solution and the seven-state solution, but unless I missed it, I didn't hear you say anything about the one-state solution. So I'd like to know what you feel the prospects of that are, and to what extent that idea has taken root among both the Palestinians and the Israelis.
I'm wondering about your thoughts about the dangers of being a journalist, especially an alternative point of view journalist, based upon what we're seeing both in this country and abroad.
I'd like to know what you think Americans should be doing about the situation.
Hi, I'm Yara. I'm Lisa. I'm also Jewish and daughter of a Holocaust survivor. I was hoping, this is either a question or a suggestion for your next book, to talk a little bit about what it's like to be an Israeli, period, let alone a journalist, living in Ramallah, and then what it's like for you when you come inside the Green Line. What are the challenges, both personally and professionally?
All right, thank you. I have a list of words that I detest. It starts with Oslo, then negotiations, then reconciliation, then dialogue, then coexistence. And lately I added to this list the word solution. So when I say, you know, when I said two-state solution and this, it was because it was, again, easier. I mean, it doesn't take too many words to explain what I mean. You know, the one state, to have one state, but which one state? Right now, we are one state. Between the river and the sea, there are two peoples. There is one government that decides about the fate of the two peoples. But there is actually only one people that really can decide what government will be. And there are different legal regimes. One which applies to Palestinians, or legal systems, one which applies to Palestinians, one which applies to Israelis, and more so. The one that applies to Palestinians, actually the Palestinians are subdivided into groups according to where they live. Not like South Africa, where people were divided by the color, but here it's where they are divided by their where they live. So a Gazan is not treated the same by Israel as somebody from Ramallah, or somebody in Jerusalem, or somebody who is an Israeli citizen in Israel proper. But they are all discriminated against as a rule when it comes. And as I said before, it's not only Israeli Jews who have more rights in the country than Palestinians, it's the Jews among you have already more rights in Israel and in the country than a Palestinian. So this is one state. Now we want to change it to be a state which respects Jewish legacy, as we saw it, or lessons from Jewish plights. We want to change it. Do I see, is it feasible now that we can convince the Israeli Jews that one state is better, one state based on equality is better for them than the reality today? No. Because Israelis, and Netanyahu is so strong because Israelis profit from the occupation. They like it. I mean, they got used to it. Oslo helped them to really to not see those enclaves. Palestinians are congested in those unseen enclaves. They drive in the highways in the West Bank, and they cannot tell what is Israel, what is not Israel, because it looks the same. On the road signs, along the roads, you don't have Palestinian villages mentioned. You have Ramallah mentioned, yes, big favor. And you have Nablus, because we still aspire to return to Nablus. Look, I don't know if you ever want to come for a visit and you have 3 days or 2 days, go to Hebron. Hebron summarizes Israeli plans for Palestinians. So these Israelis will want one state which is based on equality. Now, how to convince the Israelis? You know, I am among one of those groups that over the years tried to convince the Israelis in different ways. That it's not, that it's immoral, it's not Jewish, it's not going to work, it's not going to hold, it's unreasonable. You know, we tried to convince and we failed. And we also failed in our doomsday prophecies, because that's fine, it works. The world accepts us. The world doesn't boycott us. The world, on the contrary, we are more now accepted and welcome even in Arab states. We sell our military expertise and military know-how and military products to Arab states and to other countries and Muslim states. Indonesia doesn't have diplomatic relations with us, but they buy our drones. So, you know, you can talk about one state like those people who say that after life God will punish the people. And I feel that sometimes that's how people talk about one state solution. Like, you know, one day this will happen. I think we have to talk about more political terms and political actions. The idea of one state also develops from the notion that, okay, the settlers won, and we cannot remove the settlements. So exactly that's what they want, but they are there, the settlers are there, not in order to have equality, but the opposite. So I prefer to talk about principles, I prefer to talk about fundamentals, such as there is one country, there are two peoples. And to say to the Palestinians, the Jews are not going to disappear. Because you have Palestinians who do talk about one state, but as I say it in a shorthand, I say they talk about one state without Jews. They will not undo history. But if this life in this country is not based on equality, and we'll decide how to materialize the principle of equality into political realities, then, now I want to say, then we'll face disasters, or things will explode. But I must say that I am aware that right now, Palestinians do talk that they want to explode, but they do not. Because they know from the lesson of the second Intifada, and even the first one, that if they embark on an uprising now, the Israeli countermeasures, counterattacks, will be so, so painful, and might include expulsion, mass expulsion. That's why the right wing wants wars. The right wing, and especially the messianic right wing, always supports wars, either against Gaza, or when it was the war against Iraq. They want it because this gives chances for expulsion. The expulsions in 48, 49 were enabled because of the wars, as in Nazi Germany, in Nazi Europe. So, I'm sorry, it's like for me, talking about one state is like talking about afterlife right now. I was asked about the dangers as a journalist. The truth is that right now, and for 30 years already, I'm almost totally protected as a journalist. That's why I say when people say, oh, courageous, etc., it's not, because I'm not facing the repression that, for example, journalists faced in Soviet Union or are facing in Putin's Russia or in South Africa or in China. We are still, Israel is a democracy for Jews. And I can say these things and write these things, and I know I'm not facing any danger. There is no, neither is there official censorship to what I'm saying. There is social censorship. Social censorship that influences the editors used to influence them much more in the past, of course. But I'm not in danger. And still I think that in the United States I'm white and I don't face danger in I'm considered white, which is very strange for me as a Jew and as a child of survivors, but I'm considered white. What should the United States do? Wow, I don't know. I mean, what should Americans do? Vote Sanders and... but then also, this is a question I will leave you to answer for me, okay? Yeah. Now, what is it for me to live in... The question was, what is it for me to live in Ramallah and to go to the Israeli side? And, you know, sometimes I feel that I live in both societies and I know both societies. Sometimes I feel that I'm a stranger in both societies. It changes. I'm happy that I can exercise my ideal. I mean, that I can materialize my ideology into a lifestyle, where I can answer the phone in Hebrew, and then it turns out somebody speaks in Arabic, so I switch to Arabic, and vice versa. And when I already dream in Arabic, it's nice. But I do feel estranged from the Israeli society because of these changes over the years and because of the way that they accept what is happening. And they are so oblivious to the reality. You know, when I go out of Ramallah, maybe this should be a chapter in the book that you would like me to write, about what soldiers tell me at checkpoints. So very often they ask me, wow, you're Jewish. Aren't you afraid when you go? You know, I'm coming out of the enclaves. I'm coming out of the den. So am I not afraid? And I say, yes, of course I'm afraid. When you bombed us, of course I was afraid. When you bombed us, when you had the cannons near my house and the tanks near my house and shooting at us in demonstrations. No, it's not what I mean, the soldier tells me. Like, completely oblivious to his own military might and what it is doing. And they can also tell me, I will not even enter with my gun to Ramallah. Or without my gun, I will not enter. So I say, maybe this is the reason that you are afraid, that you enter with your gun. Another time, it was in a happier moment, back in 2002, the same checkpoint that was closed for many months and then opened, and then a soldier looked at me and looked at my identity card, and then again at me. And this is, again, the checkpoints between one enclave to another. It's not, or one enclave to Mexico, completely Israeli-controlled area, and then leading to another enclave. So he looked and he said, but you are Jewish, what are you doing here? So I answered, you are also Jewish, what are you doing here? So this was a happy moment, but unfortunately it was, we have to single it out, the happy moment that it answered, believe me, I have no idea. So this was a nice, yeah.
What do you see the situation in 5 years, 10 years?
My beloved question that I have a beloved answer, that the crystal ball is not with me. I'm sorry, I refuse to prophesize. I think that it's in our hands to affect what's happening. So there are many factors here, many, many variables that we have to work on changing them and on activating them, and not just to prophesize. I mean, I can say that, yeah, it's very bleak. How bleak? In what ways? I don't know. But while I'm saying this, I hope that something will happen that changes it. Miracles.
I was wondering if there are any positive signs within Israeli politics that you can see? Any people?
No comment.
Thank you very much. I'm informed that you have to leave with you now. Yeah.
Yes, we
can. There are cards for sale up here at the front if you'd like to come and check these out.